Call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And today is Human Services Day in the Health Committee. I think maybe you were actually misnamed this year. We probably should be Health and Human Services, kind of lining up with the Senate. But so, folks, the first order of business, and I should say a quorum is present. The first we'll do approval of the minutes of March 9th. They are in your packets. Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, I make a motion to approve the minutes.
All right. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? They prevail.
I was really excited.
Your vote is very important, Representative Smith. All right.
Is there more paper?
That's right. Never fail to vote. You might be the only vote. Okay, so the first bill that we are going to take up this morning is House File 2712, Representative Fisher, and his motion is going to be that House File 2712 be recommended to be placed on the general register. And Representative Fisher, I think we should maybe do a little explanation of kind of just what we're doing here so folks understand, because it's my understanding that House File 2712, the contents of it will be in our coming into the DHS bill that's before us today. So we want to discuss the contents as part of the presentation we're going to hear today, because this is the it's a policy bill related to the Office of Inspector General. Representative Fisher, is that right?
Yes, Chair Liebling. It's related to the Office of the Inspector General. This is a pure policy bill. The reason we have it out there is in case we needed it, honestly, as a vehicle bill to line up with over at the Senate on any of the policy items that fall into this part of the world.
Okay, thank you. So I hope everybody kind of understands that, you know, just to be perfectly transparent about what we're doing here. So the content of the bill is content that is here before this committee and part of our discussion from DHS, the items that are before us from DHS. But the bill itself is being placed on the general register just in case it should be needed as a policy vehicle bill.
That is correct, Chair.
All right. So with that, Representative Fisher, please go ahead and present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee, for the opportunity for House File 2712. This bill makes policy changes to statutes guiding the Office of the Inspector General's work and program licensing, background studies, and program integrity. In the licensing area, it expands the requirement that the Department of Human Service license programs document the first date of direct contact for new staff. It makes multiple modifications to Chapter 245A to align with past statutory changes and current practices and to provide additional clarity for license holders. It also adds a license holder's email to the list of data. And we have a background studies provision. This bill also provides clarity to the background studies in DHS. It updates Chapter 245C, and in the program integrity, enhances Department of Human Services efforts around program integrity. This bill will streamline and clarify the reconsideration process for providers and hospitals. And I also have Autumn Baum here from the department in case there's any questions on this part. I also know it's part of the package that will be coming up before us.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Fisher. So I don't see any amendment here on the bill today. And
that
of course,
is correct.
One wouldn't expect that since the content is kind of not the key thing in terms of our moving the bill.
Correct.
But so, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? All right, I don't see anyone. Is there any discussion from members? Everyone kind of understands what we're doing. Representative Nadeau.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and thank you. And thank you, Representative Fisher. There's a lot in here on background study changes. Can you talk about that in depth? I mean, most 245A, 245, 256, these background studies are conducted by DHS using NET study, as far as I understand. I don't mean to put words in your mouth. I think that's what it is. Can you just talk about the general effect of what these background changes are doing for me, please?
Representative Fisher.
I will defer to my helper here.
Okay. And before you go ahead, just let me kind of repeat that. We're after this bill, which hopefully will get this done quickly here. We're going to have a complete presentation from the Commissioner of Human Services, Department of Human Services, who is here waiting, so we can have a more robust discussion of background studies, absolutely, because it is a big, important piece of what they do. But please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Good morning, members. My name is Autumn Baum, and I am the Legislative Director for the Office of Inspector General at DHS. Madam Chair, Representative, I would say that the background studies portions of the proposal in general will add and clarify requirements and DHS authority to conduct background studies for various types. Really, we're trying to address some Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and FBI concerns with the sharing of background study data and complying with some data sharing principles related to the minimum necessary.
Representative Dundo.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you so much. So any other questions or comments from the committee? Okay. Not seeing any. So with that, Representative Fisher is going to renew his motion that House File 2712 be placed on the general register. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill will be placed on the general register. Thank you very much. Okay. So with that, we're going to now, I'm the author of House File 2900, so I'm going to move House File 2900 to bring it before the committee. And House File 2900, I'm moving it to be laid over for possible inclusion.
We have you already.
And then we have an A1 amendment in our packets. And so once again, I want to give the committee a little bit of explanation here of what we're doing. So what you have before you is the 2900. 2900 is the DHS budget bill, and there has been some rearranging of jurisdictions, and so there is an A1 amendment here in the packet. And what the A1 amendment does is straighten out the items that are in our jurisdiction in this committee, and also I think do some updating so that the revised budget is contained, the revisions, as I understand it, are contained in the A1 amendment. And I think I might call on Mr. Chun to explain that, but before I do, just let me explain a little bit about what we're going to do in terms of our procedure here. So we have 2900 before us. The commissioner's here to give us a presentation of her agency's budget. We're not going to move the A1 amendment. This is similar to the procedure we did the other day with the Department of Health's budget. So I'm bringing the amendment here so that it is, this is sort of like creating a menu for our eventual omnibus bill. So the A1 amendment is not formally moved, but it is here so you can all, you know, read it, understand what the changes are. We're going to have a discussion on this. But we're not going to actually move that amendment. But Mr. Chun, please go ahead.
So, Madam Chair and members, the A1 amendment does a number of things. It sort of conforms the bill to the committee's jurisdiction, so it takes out certain articles that aren't under the committee's jurisdiction. It adds other provisions. The amendment also contains, technical changes or technical amendments either done by House research staff or suggested by the Department of Human Services. And finally, the bill also includes the latest supplemental recommendations of the governor. So that's new language being added to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chun. So looked at it in its entirety here, what you have before you between the this somewhat large bill, but in the scheme of things, not that large, actually. And then the amendment, you have the Department of Human Services budget, current budget proposal that is before our committee. So with that, and the intention is, by the way, to lay this over, and then it will become parts of it, not all of it, will be coming back as a proposal in our delete everything amendment. Mr. Harney.
Madam Chair, members should have in their packet a spreadsheet on the bottom right-hand corner, dated March 22nd, 2023 at 10:31 a.m. On line 392 of that spreadsheet starts a component titled New Items to Align with the Other Body. The outline that Mr. Chun just gave lists those budget components in order, going all the way down to where the Department of Health, the Department of Health begins on page 22. It comprises 26 items.
Okay, so Representative Akam.
Just a question to the spreadsheet. The pages came around and gave us what I thought was an updated one just as we were sitting down, but they seem to be the same. Just double checking, are there differences between?
Madam Chair, Representative Akam, so long as the timestamp is the same on the bottom right, you should feel comfortable. They're the same spreadsheet.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Representative Akam. I think we have two copies. Okay. We're being super diligent today, making sure everybody gets it, so you're getting it twice. Yes, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there an electronic version of this? I don't know if it's posted online or if we got it in email. Is there one? I'll just find it if there is.
Mr. Harney?
I sent one to all committee staff and members yesterday afternoon. I can resend that to you, to everyone.
If you sent it yesterday afternoon, I will find it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And before we go to the commissioner for her presentation, I just want to make sure everybody kind of understands the process that we're doing here and what's in front of you. And so any other questions to that? All right. I don't see any. So thank you. Thank you so much. Let me just acknowledge that our nonpartisan staff have been working, as they always do, nonstop to get this all lined up and ready for what we have today. And their work just kind of starting, too. So I hope everybody is aware of how hard they work to make it seem like we know what we're doing. So with that, Commissioner, welcome to the committee. We're looking forward to hearing from you. And please go ahead.
Thank you so much. I'm Jody Harpstead, the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, and pleased to be here today to show you the Department of Human Services portion of the Governor's One Minnesota budget, recently revised, as you know, so we can see the whole thing now in one place. So next slide. Yep, there we go. So the budget package we have is centered around the people that we support. On the left side of this slide, you can see that we now serve 48% of Minnesota's children in one way or another, 37% of people with disabilities in Minnesota, for example, and about improving the health and human services system. On the right, you can see the pieces of the puzzle that we work through to implement human services in the state of Minnesota, since we are a state-funded, county, and tribal-administered system. It's all got to work together. The pillars that informed our budget package for DHS this year were the following. As the governor and lieutenant governor stayed often, to make Minnesota the best place for all children, including black, brown, and indigenous children, to grow up. We always add at DHS, remaining one of the top five states in the nation for older adults and people with disabilities to live in. Transforming the health and human services system so that it simply works better for people. Taking a stand for racial justice, gender justice, housing justice, and health justice, along with our partners in the Interagency Council on Homelessness, and increasing our operational effectiveness and facilitating the co-creation of solutions with partners. You can see on the next slide a summary of our total budget package. You can see our proposal includes about $2 billion in the first biennium and $2.8 billion in the second. And if you look at the total column, you can see how we are talking about investing $1.7 billion for children and families and $1.5 billion for long-term care and workforce, as we said in our opening pillars about our intention to support both parts of the long-term care and generally the caring professions sectors. You can also see an historic investment in behavioral health and so many other areas. So we're pleased to show you the details here soon. And the next slide shows you the budget package proposals that are in the jurisdiction of the committee, a total of about almost a billion, 50 proposals, which we will try to get through quickly. Next slide.
And Commissioner, if I could just ask you to pull the mic just a little closer.
Okay, sorry.
Because the microphones in this room are not very good. So.
Thank you. Is that
Thank
better?
You. Yes, it is. Thank you.
I can hear myself better. All right. So first, I was just going to present the first set of proposals.
You might have to stop. It looks like we set the wrong PowerPoint.
Yeah, that's not what we have.
Yeah, it's so different than what
pull
we...
up my own computer.
Okay, we can pause for a moment on that. And members have the slide, the presentation in your packets too, so.
So does your next slide say agency effectiveness and service
yes.
delivery transformation?
Yes.
Then I'll just go ahead. You can look at it there. First of all, under agency effectiveness, there's always our proposal for our operating adjustment to keep our staff strong and supported and in place to support all the rest of these things. We are excited about the possibilities of everything flowing through the legislature this session. We're also slightly intimidated by it because we know it's going to land on our shop at the end of session, and there's a lot of work to do. So first, our operating adjustment. Secondly, our continuous improvement and compliance expansion proposal is something held over from last year. We put it in last year, and we talked then often about how we could imagine it bringing us to the ninth inning of that nine-inning ball game that we've been playing since I became commissioner to improve the effectiveness of the agency, the systems and processes that we use to ensure no errors in our work. And it didn't pass at the end of session last year. We really need it this year, and you would want us to have it so that we can continue to do a great job of being really effective at handling the funds that you entrust us with. And then the service delivery transformation and IT infrastructure is a look at our next several years of our what we call service delivery transformation instead of the IT budget, because we center it on the people who use our services and what it takes to sign up for them, what it takes for providers to do grants and to get our dollars to put them into service. And so all of these pieces are needed to help us have a much smoother running health and human services system across the state of Minnesota. We're in conversations with many of you now about the enormous COVID unwind or Medicaid recertification process we're about to start. And can't we automatically renew people? And shouldn't we be able to make that simpler? And we really, really need this bill to pass, these proposals, to start even going down the path of getting better at the kinds of things that you expect us to do. These also include, over time, improving and modernizing and changing out some of our long-term mainframe systems into much more workable user-friendly applications. And so those are the kinds of things that we really need to see an investment in. It's a great use of one-time money so that we can continue to make things easier for people to use across the state. And have you caught up with us now?
I don't know how to make it go up there, honestly. So
kind of support?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there pink? Yeah, we'll see if we can get some assistance. Okay, we're on it.
Thank you.
We're working on it anyway.
Sorry about that.
Would you like to go ahead with the next slides? And that is okay.
With that, I think Ms. Graham is coming.
Thank you very much. I'll still be here for questions.
Okay, thank you. All right, and Ms. Graham, and please welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record, and then if you could just. If you have the same slides as we do, if you can just orient us to what slide you're on so that we can, at least the committee can be looking at it. And I apologize for the public. Anybody watching online, of course, isn't able to see what we're doing here, but you're kind of just reading through the slides that are before us. And do we have the slide deck posted? Or we can have it posted on our website. It is posted on our webpage, I assume. So. Well, that's a place the public can look at it also. Okay, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Christy Graham, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. So I'm going to be going over, I'll start with slide 8. And so these are investments in our children's and adult behavioral health system, really to ensure that we're making adequate and increased investments in that, not just the physical health part of our system.
And Ms. Graham, I'm having difficulty hearing you because we do have these terrible mics. Maybe adjust it a little and see if we can pick up your voice a little better. Oh, there. Thank you.
Madam Chair, is that better?
That is better, yes.
Okay. So slide 8.
Okay. Slide 8.
To reorient everyone, members, Madam Chair. So slide 8 is related to our children's and adult behavioral health investments. So these, many of these proposals are quite dense, so I'll just maybe pick a few highlights from each of the each of the parts that are listed on the slide that will be in your packets or posted online soon. And we've got a total investment in this area of around $31 million in the first biennium and then $36 million in 26-27. When it comes to expediting access to behavioral health services, a few things that we're looking at in this particular package are allowing hospitals, federally qualified health centers, and rural health clinics to be able to provide substance use disorder comprehensive assessments. So right now, those assessments are being provided by substance use disorder providers primarily. But we want to make sure that people, when they go into the clinic, when they go and get their physical health care, that they can also access that assessment and be referred to treatment services if needed. And so right now, these particular providers would have to obtain a whole separate license to be able to do that. We've also got investments in this package related to a couple of really effective and important grant programs that support people experiencing homelessness or people at risk of experiencing homelessness. So these are the housing with supports for adults and with serious mental illness and the projects for assistance in transition from homelessness grants. So we've got provisions that will both expand eligibility here as well as expand the investment. And so these are services that support people to transition out of homelessness with case management, substance use disorder services, all kinds of wraparound supports to make sure that they can get themselves out of homelessness, and then when they get to housing, to be able to support their behavioral health needs when they're there so that they can maintain that housing. In terms of Behavioral Health 49, improving access to behavioral health services, several investments in this package. One of them that I want to highlight is related to covering expenses, covering room and board expenses for children's residential facilities, for children who are in those facilities, but they are not part of entering those facilities through our child protection system. So last session, or a couple sessions ago, DHS worked with community partners to make sure that in order to access this critical medical assistance benefit, we do not have to force families to actually go into child protection to access that funding. However, there are some funding gaps in doing that, and so this proposal adds forecasted funding to be able to support those children and families who need those critical residential services. Also in this part of the package is an increase to our adult day treatment rate. So these are important services provided in the hospital typically or in a hospital setting to help people step down from institutional care or inpatient psychiatric care, or to help prevent people from having to need to go to those higher levels of care. These rates are extremely insufficient at this time, so we're proposing a 50% rate increase to be able to maintain those critical services in our communities across the state. We've also got funding in this proposal for the Transition to Community Initiative. We're expanding this particular grant program to make sure that children have access to this. And this is a grant program that really helps people who are in institutions and who might have medical assistance, but medical assistance might not cover all of the support that they need to transition out of a hospital or an institutional setting. And so these are extremely effective interventions that we provide through this grant funding. And we, knowing the hospital decompression issues at hand, we want to make sure that we're making investments here to continue that good work. There was some one-time funding for this grant in 2021, and so we would like to extend that funding as part of this proposal. And then moving to the behavioral health workforce, certainly workforce is something we talk about all across our health and human services and other economic sectors. So members, I'm sure you're very familiar with the issues, but in Minnesota, we have most parts of the state for the past almost decade have been designated a federally designated workforce shortage area. We've got the metro areas and some parts of southern Minnesota that are a little bit better, but certainly lacking in culturally responsive services. So we've got some pretty significant investments here in our cultural and ethnic minority infrastructure grant. This is a grant that helps pay providers, mental health providers, substance use disorder providers, to be able to pay for those supervision costs that are needed for mental health and substance use disorder professionals to obtain licensure and to be able to continue to serve the their community. Also in this proposal, there is an important investment in our psychiatric residential treatment facilities, or PRTFs. You probably have heard a lot about these over the course of this session and previous sessions. These are extremely effective models. They are in dire need right now. There are some hoops that providers have to jump through, some federal hoops that they have to jump through in order to start these facilities And it can be very challenging to have the funds available when you're not able to bill for the services. So we've got startup grants, and we'd like to increase our startup grants for these PRTF facilities to facilitate more of them getting started, more children and families having access to this this treatment. We'd also like to add specialization grants so that PRTF providers who are willing to serve children who might be labeled as having aggressive behaviors, might be having sexually manifesting behaviors, other kinds of challenging behaviors, PTSD, for example, disabilities, co-occurring disorders, that we can provide them with some additional funds to be able to serve those populations so that they're not languishing in, you know, hospitals or in home settings with their family, which aren't safe. And then moving to Behavioral Health 52, our mental health crisis and early intervention proposal. So this is quite a few investments in this proposal. I'll note just a couple. There's an investment in our first episode psychosis program. This is a grant program. There's based on decades, several decades of research. It's an evidence-based program that involves a team supporting people in the early phases of psychosis. So typically between 25 and 35, I believe, but this goes, I think, serves people up to 40 to really make sure that they've got wraparound services and all the family supports that they need to be able to address their symptoms and have better outcomes. So we've got an investment here. We'd really like to focus that investment, if the legislature chooses, on a rural setting. We've got four total FEP, first episode psychosis programs in the state. Three of those are in the metro area, and one of them is in greater Minnesota. So we'd like to expand in that sense. And maybe in the interest of time, I'll move to the next slide.
Okay. Ms. Graum, actually, I'm going to interrupt you for a second because we can get some IT assistance here. If we can, you know, just kind of take a pause for a moment and let her give us some assistance.
Madam Chair, while we're doing that.
Yeah.
May I just ask, also, I've tried to look through my documents, and maybe I can't find it. The big book, did we get an electronic version of this as well? And where should I look for it? I didn't see it online posted.
We emailed it out. Yeah, Representative New Brindley, that was emailed out, and that would have come
from Josh.
You're right. From we can resend that, but yes. And we also,
I didn't know
if we printed books, but everyone's had those change pages and the reissuance of the whole budget with change pages. I know we did send it out. And that's what this book is.
Yeah.
And that's, does everyone have that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and everyone has it also. You were asking about the electronic.
Yeah, I can't deal with,
you
see all.
No, I hear you. It's often easier to scan for a.
And I can take notes and
for
keep
something.
Track of it if I've got
totally.
One small place.
That's right. Okay, and just to clarify, Representative New Brindley, so it was sent out as a link, not as an actual attachment.
PDF.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, and Mr. Sandy just resent that as well.
Thank you so much. I appreciate
sure.
that.
No problem.
It's got
a lot to go through here. Yay, thank you so much. All right, so why don't you, if you could, just reorient us, and well, I'll give you a moment there to get your slide where it needs to be. And get the right view. Maybe there's the presentation view or whatever they call that.
Oh,
there we go.
I learned a new thing, too.
All right, very good. So it looks like then we are actually on page 9, which is what we're showing here. Excellent. Okay, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. So the housing justice part of our budget is primarily in Articles 5 and 6 of the bill. And the first proposal I want to talk about with the committee today is our addressing deep poverty proposal. This is about, the entire package is around $16 million in the first biennium and $36 million in the tails.
You blow it up everywhere.
Never mind. We'll work on the numbers and make sure you have the correct numbers. Anyway, so for the deep poverty proposal, being in deep poverty means that someone's income is half of the federal poverty level. So this is around $1,100 for a single adult and about $560 for, is poverty, and then about $570 a month is considered deep poverty, just to kind of orient you to what that means. And so this is a condition that, a situation that many Minnesotans find themselves in, typically when, for a variety of reasons, they're unable to work, or the work that's available to them isn't able to help them pay their bills, their basic expenses like housing, healthcare, etc. In 2020, we worked with the University of Minnesota to really take a look at deep poverty and to understand how it's impacting our medical assistance program. And what researchers found and what DHS found is that about a little bit over 4% of Minnesotans were covered by medical assistance and are living in deep poverty, have higher rates of chronic health conditions than the other adults who receive medical assistance. So the recommendations from that report were that we make some intentional changes in our public assistance programs to really address this and to understand that poverty isn't just a social determinant of health issue. It's really impacting people's cognitive health, their cognitive functioning, their biological functioning. And so one thing that we've actually learned from that study is that county rankings indicated that even more than health behavior, clinical care, and physical environment, that social and economic factors had a bigger impact on people's health care conditions and outcomes. So this is a really important reason or proposal for many reasons. And what it includes is the probably largest piece of this proposal is increasing our general assistance payment rates. For this is a program, general assistance, that's available for people with disabilities, older adults, people with disabling conditions, things like behavioral health conditions. And it's really in place to make sure that people can maintain a basic dignity and decency and health as they await to transition to other more permanent programs like Social Security disability or employment. They might have a chronic health condition or a complex acute health condition that will heal, and they can go off of this program at some point. So this is really a bridge program, and it hasn't had investment since 1986. Right now, the current monthly amount is $203 a month, which is not enough to meet the purpose of the program. And so we are proposing in this budget to increase that to the MFIP one-person standard and to index that with inflation in a similar way that MFIP was a few years ago. So this is a really high priority investment for us for all of the reasons that I mentioned. I will note that going into maybe the next part of this proposal, we're making some changes around when people on general assistance and housing support need to apply for other benefits. So as I mentioned, the people people have to apply for other benefits when they're on this general assistance program. Right now they have 30 days in law to do that, and that's really not a sufficient amount of time for people to get the kind of advocacy resources that they need to be successful with the Social Security application process. So we are in law and aligning with the recommendations from the Deep Poverty Report, expanding that window so that people have 90 days to apply for other programs to help support them. I will say that when people transition off of general assistance or housing support and they're getting Social Security, there is a recovery process in place where those monies come back to the state, where counties work with people to make sure that the amount of funding that they got while they were on that program is eventually returned to the state. And then lastly in this package is a provision related to drug testing for people on public assistance programs who have felony drug convictions. So this proposal is really about local authority. We've heard from counties and tribes across the state that this is not something that mandatory drug testing for these populations and sanctioning them is not something that they're largely interested in doing. And so this proposal makes that optional for counties and tribes. They could still continue to do it if they wanted to, but what we've heard from many areas is that this is essentially an unfunded mandate. And so we want to make sure that counties and tribes and local governments have that ability to make decisions that are best for their community. So this would make it optional to do those felony drug testing requirements and remove the sanctions, really kind of punishing people with behavioral health issues is not an effective way to help serve them. And so what we would like our counties and our tribes to do, and what they many of them prefer to do, is just to support people and getting resources so that they can go to treatment and get assistance for the health conditions that they're struggling with. The improvements to housing stabilization services in Article 6. Housing stabilization services is a medical assistance benefit. It's a newer one that supports people who are transitioning either from homelessness or might be at risk of losing their housing. And so it's for people who have disabilities, who are older adults, who might need some additional wraparound services. And so this is a way that we can provide some of those housing services and also leverage that federal match. And so those particular housing stabilization services rates are historic rates. We kind of set those in stone. And so this particular proposal would add an inflationary update so that providers are better able to get reimbursed for that service and provide that service to the community. And our strengthening adult income supports proposal, moving to the next bullet on your screens. One of the proposals I want to note in here is transitioning our housing support program to what most rental programs are, which is a person is required to pay 30% of their rent, 30% of their income toward housing, which is generally kind of the acceptable, affordable level of what people should have to pay for their housing to meet their other needs. In our housing support program, people are sometimes paying almost, especially people with unearned income, oftentimes Social Security, are paying almost all of their check for housing. And what we want to make sure that we're doing is we're not disincentivizing people who might be getting Social Security and living in a shelter from moving into their own apartment where they're better supported, they have better health outcomes. And we also want to make sure that people are able to save more of their money and be able to afford some of their basic expenses. So this particular proposal would change that model to a 30% income model for people in community settings who are receiving unearned income. And then lastly, I'll mention the next bullet point, reducing recidivism. This is related to a really, there's a couple parts of this proposal. The first one is related to a very successful program that DHS operates in coordination with the Department of Corrections, where we identify folks in our correctional system who are at high risk of recidivism, many of whom have behavioral health issues. And we actually send case management type workers into those settings. We get them connected to benefits before they're discharged, before they exit into the community, whether that's housing benefits or public cash assistance benefits, or just getting, you know, set up at the local mental health clinic in their neighborhood, making sure they've got access to transportation. This is a very, very successful kind of low-touch, low-cost program that we run, and we got some temporary funding to expand this in 2021, and we do need to be able to continue that so we can continue to serve people and create these really positive outcomes that we're seeing. And then lastly, in this proposal, we do have a proposal for presumptive housing support eligibility for people who are likely eligible for housing support and they're in a Minnesota correctional facility, for them to be able to get housing support for 3 months without having to complete, you know, check all of the boxes and get their paperwork done. So they've got 3 months to get that done, and then they've got their housing, and they can either transition to staying on that program or transition to, if they maybe have employment or another housing opportunity, to another form of stable housing instead of being exited into either on the streets or in an emergency shelter or doubled up. And so that is a very, very high level overview of our proposals in my area. Happy to answer questions or just turn it over to Ms. Bobbs.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Grom. I mean, it's I have to say it's impressive. I really do think it is. Thank you. Okay. Ms. Bobbs, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Can I add one thing? Sorry.
Yes, certainly. And you need to introduce yourself for the record, too.
Thanks. Elise Bailey, Budget Director. I'm noticing that the PowerPoint has the wrong numbers. So they're wrong all over the place. So I just wanted to let folks know that these squares are incorrect.
Okay.
And I apologize. And we'll provide the committee with
right, but Ms. Bailey, the spreadsheet that we've
the
gotten
spreadsheet is correct.
Has the real numbers on
yes.
it, right?
Yes.
And do the change pages that we all have that we were discussing, we have the link, so those have the correct numbers?
Yep.
Correct?
That's
okay.
correct. Yep.
All right.
I apologize.
All right. Yeah. Please proceed.
Right, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ann Botts, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Healthcare Administration at the department. And just to help orient members, the Healthcare Administration is the part of the department that oversees Minnesota's public health care program, so medical assistance and Minnesota care. I'll be sharing information about budget priorities to strengthen and expand our public health care programs. So on this first slide, you will see some of the budget items that relate to healthcare access and affordability. I will note on the next couple of slides, we have a lot of proposals, so I'm not going to touch on them all, just give you some of the highlights. So healthcare 64, ensuring eligible Minnesotans retain coverage, that is our proposal for the unwinding process for redeterminations coming out of the federal changes related to the continuous coverage. And so that, as members may remember, was heard recently in this committee and passed out of committee and passed out of Ways and Means. So thank you for your attention to that item. Healthcare 66, which is expanding MA coverage for children. You may remember hearing about continuous eligibility for children in previous conversations about House File 914 and House File 2286, both of which are being carried by Chair Knorr. So in addition to allowing DHS to come into compliance with the new federal requirement for 12 months of continuous MA eligibility for children, Minnesota could be among the first states in the nation to extend up to 72 months of continuous MA eligibility for children under age 6. And the first waiver to do so was approved in Oregon last year. Healthcare 65, which is improving healthcare access for Minnesotans, works to address several barriers to Minnesota healthcare program coverage that currently eligible Minnesotans face when they're trying to apply and enroll, with a particular eye on addressing language barriers. This proposal also funds community-driven improvements to MA and Minnesota care, invests in enhancements to the online portal for both consumers and assisters in METS, which is the Minnesota Eligibility Technology System. And this proposal also extends Minnesota care coverage to undocumented children through age 18. Healthcare 47 eliminates copays and the family deductible in medical assistance, as was discussed in committee as part of the conversation on House File 1030, carried by Chair Liebling. Some but not all enrollees are subject to cost sharing, and many but not all services have copays or deductible applied to them. So the elimination of copays and medical assistance will help support low-income families for whom these copays may be a financial burden, as well as ease administrative burdens on providers. This next slide highlights proposals in the budget that seek to improve health outcomes and advance health equity in MIM Minnesota care. As you heard during committee discussion on Dental Day, access to dental care remains an ongoing challenge for our public program enrollees. So the governor and lieutenant governor's budget seeks to make additional improvements to dental access by expanding the adult dental benefit set, which is also being carried in House File 898 by Representative Bierman, and rebasing our dental rates to update the spread of cost reimbursement, a regular rebasing moving forward, and inflationary adjustments, which is similar to the language being carried by Representative Breyer in House File 1541. Healthcare 77 is a proposal to remove the requirement of supervision for practicing doulas by a licensed provider. The licensed supervisor issue has been cited as a reason that doulas struggle to provide services to our public program enrollees or sustain services if they are able to navigate that process initially. Healthcare 87, which is the use of audio only in telehealth. As members may remember, back in 2021, the legislature expanded the use of audio only telehealth through June 30th of 2023, as DHS and MDH were taking on a study on the use of audio-only telehealth in health in our programs. This proposal will extend that allowance for the use of audio-only telehealth to remain in place through June 30th of 2025, while DHS and MDH continue to study the impacts and usage of audio-only telehealth and make future recommendations for the use of audio-only going forward. Healthcare 78, which is preserving funding for medical education and research costs, that's also known as the Merck program. This proposal will replace lost funding for Merck in accordance with federal guidance and allows the state to preserve the vast majority of these payments to providers. Components of this proposal are being carried by both DHS and MDH, as this is a program that we work on together. And then there are also several budget proposals on this slide to support Minnesota's tribal nations. Healthcare 81 is supporting tribal providers and payments. This is a proposal to support tribal providers through compliance with the federal four walls policy And states are expected to comply with that four walls policy 9 months after the end of the federal public health emergency for COVID-19, and that's currently scheduled to end on May 11th. We also plan in this proposal to work collaboratively with the tribes to support the unique needs of tribal members and their ability to provide culturally appropriate services for their members. This proposal also includes dedicated staffing to assist tribes and tribal providers with technical assistance, policy and rate analysis, compliance review, and support for identifying and initiating tribal consultation when needed.
And Ms. Pops, could you just say something a bit more about what the four walls policy is? I don't think we can assume everyone knows that.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I will do my best, and I may ask a friend to follow up.
Just something brief. Yeah. We can always come back
to it. So this is a change in financing for tribal providers and relates to the services that they would provide outside of the four walls of their clinics that are on reservations. It is a federal change that is changing some of the funding mechanism related to that. We have been working very closely with the tribes over the past year to make sure that we are addressing their unique needs with each tribal nation to address compliance with this policy, while also trying to hold the providers harmless as closely as possible.
Thank you.
Our next tribal provider is healthcare, or tribal provider is Healthcare 61, supporting healthcare coverage for urban Indians. This proposal recognizes that the state has been receiving additional federal funding for urban Indian organizations in Minnesota through the Federal American Rescue Plan Act. And this proposal would give the department authority to recapture funds from the general fund from that enhanced federal funding and pass it through to the Indian Health Board of Minneapolis, which is our urban Indian organization. And you'll hear more about the Indian Health Board in tonight's discussion of House File 2267, which is being carried by Representative Keeler. House File 2267 carries the same amount of grant funding for the IHB that is in the governor's revised budget. And then the last bullet on the slide and our final tribal proposal is AD72, which is the establishment of a dedicated tribal elder office at DHS. This will seeks to do three primary things. It will first build technical expertise within DHS to maximize the amount of federal funding available to tribes. Second, build capacity within tribal nations to provide long-term care services and supports to their members. And third, convene and facilitate a tribal state long-term services and supports work group in order to identify and implement tribal priorities for their service infrastructure. And then finally, I just want to highlight a few proposals in the governor's budget related to federal compliance and operational needs. Healthcare 44, which is improving program integrity in Minnesota healthcare programs. This proposal will increase staffing for the provider enrollment team at DHS that will seek to help promote legal compliance, reduce wait times for provider screening, enrollment, and revalidation, enable our response to respond to audit findings, and ensure that state and federal Medicaid resources are apportioned to the appropriate providers and Medicaid services. This proposal will also fund three new Project ECHO sites to focus on interventions aimed at reducing health disparities. Then Healthcare 48, which is the Drug Formulary Committee modifications proposal. This proposal will expand the membership of the Drug Formulary Committee to add an additional consumer representative seat to be held by a current or former Minnesota Healthcare Program enrollee, and add flexibility to add up to two additional seats as needed for healthcare provider representation. This proposal also eliminates the sunset of the committee, which is currently scheduled for June 30th of 2023. The committee may remember previous discussions on the DFC as Representative Bierman's bill, House File 1159, also makes changes to the Drug Formulary Committee. The rest of the proposals on this slide are fairly technical and or budget neutral proposals. So in the interest of time, I will stop here and turn it over to Ms. Modi.
All right. Thank you so much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kulani Moti, and I serve as the Inspector General here at DHS, and we'll be going over the budget proposals for the Office of Inspector General. So Op 76 is our critical resources for licensing. This proposal will strengthen core functions of DHS licensing, which includes licensing and oversight of our home and community-based services, child and adult foster care, and child care centers, our maltreatment investigations, and the department's responses to urgent program needs to ensure continuity of services for vulnerable adults and children. This proposal will benefit license holders, applicants, and vulnerable adults and children in our license programs by allowing for more timely licensing reviews and maltreatment investigations and quicker responses to questions, concerns, and complaints, and a more expeditious processing of applications. Op 79 is our family child care continuous licensing proposal. This would implement a continuous licensing process or a license that automatically renews for our family child care license holders. Currently, the system has that the family child care providers would need to reapply for a license and submit a new application every 1 to 2 years. This proposal will make the licensing review cycle easier for family child care license holders and the county licensors by reducing redundant application requirements, streamlining the licensing reapplication process. The funding in this proposal requested would support the infrastructure needed to do this transition, including IT systems costs. And to help with this, the department proposes to cover the initial application and annual licensing fees for family child care license holders for 2 years. Then we're on to our Op 81, which is our streamlining behavioral health regulations. The Uniform Service Standards, or the USS project, is a multi-phase reform of the regulatory structure and service standards for mental health services in Minnesota. The next step in this project is to begin to create a single comprehensive licensing structure for mental health service programs. This will improve the integration of behavioral health services, reduce the administrative regulatory burdens on providers, and will ensure the clients receive services under consistent requirements. The next step for the USS project is to transition the regulation of certified community behavioral health clinics, or CCBHCs, and the services they must provide from various processes in the behavioral health division to one standard licensure process in our licensing division. Then we're on to our Op 64 for our background studies fee change. So this proposal addresses the escalating costs to conduct background studies and criminal history searches. Due to a recent fee increase in our interagency agreement with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, or the BCA, the current legislatively established fee of $42 no longer represents the average cost. This proposal will bring the background study fees in alignment with the actual processing by increasing the fee by $2 for most study types. It also adds into Chapter 245C the ability to recover the costs of tribal background studies for adoption in child foster care and allocates general funds for the cost of these background studies. It also adds language granting DHS the authority to increase fees by the amount equal to any future BCA fee increases. Op 70 is our background studies operational costs, and this proposal funds new background studies to support to strengthen our operational infrastructure and to support functions such as our legal data analytics, and would support all providers that are required to submit background studies. And this looks to increase our contact center, our research areas, to provide a provider relations training team, all things that we have heard from study subjects and providers asking us to be able to respond in a more appropriate fashion. Then we have Op 51 is our financial fraud, abuse, and investigations division. Sorry, here, notes. Program integrity enhancements. So this proposal would amend our Minnesota Statute 245-095, which is our limits on public funds, to allow DHS to take actions against providers that have been excluded from public funds administered by another Minnesota state agency or federal agency. This proposal would also develop a provider training through web-based and in-person platforms that are responsive to both our county partners and child care assistance provider feedback, and would help provide training on the onset so that funds go out the door appropriately. And then I believe we're on to Op 87, which is our fraud prevention investments for our tribal nations. This would provide startup money for White Earth, Red Lake, and Mille Lacs nations who have expressed interest and been consulted on the development of this to start or expand their FPI programs, or the Fraud Prevention Investigation Program. This will also include a tribal liaison for the Office of Inspector General to continue to work with our tribal partners. And I think, and that is all, and I will stand for any questions.
Thank you. So when we get to the thank you page, then we can shift gears.
All right. Well, thank you very much. As everybody can see, there's a lot here. And, of course, every one of these proposals represents a ton of work by the employees in DHS. And just, I think, speaking for everybody, I really appreciate that. And I think we are, you know, as I said about MDH, I think we're so fortunate to have the incredibly hardworking, intelligent, creative people working for the department that we have, and from the commissioner all on down. So thank you all so very much for this. So with that, I'm going to ask if anyone from the public would like to test. Oh, I'm sorry. We do have testifiers actually signed up. So we will go to them before we will open it up for discussion by the committee. So we have Alana Steams, if I've got that right. Welcome. And then Mary Krinke. And then I will ask if anyone else in the room wants to testify. So if anyone does, please be prepared to let me know. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead. And if you could be brief, that would be great.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Alana Steams, and I'm the Director of Program Development at AMPACT. AMPACT is the nonprofit organization that manages many of our state's AmeriCorps initiatives. Today, I am testifying in support of the provision to fund Heading Home Corps, the AmeriCorps program building capacity in our shelters, nonprofits, and schools to support families experiencing homelessness and housing instability. In your packets, members, you have a letter from Rochester Public Schools. Heading Home Corps has three AmeriCorps members serving in the Rochester schools supporting students and families experiencing homelessness. The Heading Home Corps members are helping families navigate complex systems to find affordable housing, maintain transportation to school while moving from place to place, and ensure educational stability for students. In some cases, finding housing while shelters are full is not possible. One Heading Home Corps member relayed a story of one young family with children. It was Friday, it was very cold, and they didn't have a place to stay all weekend. The Rochester Schools Heading Home Corps member knew they would be staying in their car all weekend and got them gas cards to help them stay warm. Gas cards don't sound like a solution to homelessness, but for that family, on that day, it was what they needed to stay warm and make it through to Monday. To access federal AmeriCorps funding, states and local communities must provide a local match. This bill will enable us to provide these important services without burdening our local schools and nonprofits with site fees. This is particularly important for Greater Minnesota schools and nonprofits working with limited budgets. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify. I hope you will consider funding Heading Home Corps.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And Mary Krinke. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I have four comments. They'll be brief and to certain sections of the bill. Article 7 is the behavioral health section. I'd like to draw your attention to Section 11. This provides startup and capacity building grants for the PRTFs. We have a lot of abbreviations in healthcare, I know. So this is psychiatric residential treatment facilities. This is really important right now. Hospitals are boarding more and more young people. We've had some young people that have celebrated two birthdays in a hospital. That means they've been there for over a year, guys. And so we really need to have alternatives out in the community. This is mental health services that have a housing component. The second item I'd like to showcase here is the healthcare section, Article 8, Section 4. This is a section of the bill that contains technical changes in the hospital rebasing of our inpatient fee-for-service rates. And this is where we would like to insert a terrific bill of Representative Herz, House File 2924, which is updating of our inpatient fee-for-service rates to include a couple additional years of inflation. The next item is also in the healthcare section, and this was just mentioned by Ann from the department. MHA strongly supports the COVID telehealth policies. As you all know, we have audio-only telehealth services that were started with COVID, and this extends them for at least an additional year while we are waiting for the MDH and DH study of telehealth. And then the last item that I want to mention, Madam Chair, is in Article 9, which is the MERC section, another abbreviation. MERC is Medical Education and Research Costs. And there's a new formula that is required by CMS. So DHS kind of has to do this. It's not like we can wait another year. But whenever you get a new formula, we are a little uncertain about how this is going to impact some of our members. So we may be seeking language regarding temporarily holding some of them harmless if the new formula impacts them in a negative way. The good news is the new methodology will allow MERC to leverage additional federal dollars into the MERC program. As you all may know, with the Affordable Care Act and the coverage of single adults without children up to 138% of the federal poverty guidelines, that population is covered at a 90% federal match. And so we will probably be able to leverage some additional federal dollars into the MERC program. But the timing of that means we may not have the additional money right away. And so we may be seeking some language in that section regarding temporary hold harmless language. So this MERC section is a little confusing, to say the least, but I just wanted to say we support the change that DHS needs to make. So thank you all.
And so, Ms. Krinke, before you leave the table, just a question about what you last said there. So what's the timing of your, you're talking about we may come forward with some language. I have to tell you, we're kind of at go time here. So what are you talking about in terms of the timing of this?
Madam Chair, I received some potential language last night from the organization that lobbies on behalf of the MERC program. And Mr. Pollack is in the room right now, at least he was. I don't know if this is something they are trying to present to you right away.
Okay.
So.
All right. Well, thank you for that explanation.
That's
okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill? And I'm not seeing anyone. So we'll close the testimony and we will go to member discussion. And I have Representative Quam on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is to get more a summary and some detailed information for committee members. So some of this might have to come from offline, but it'd be very useful to get a breakdown of the one-time versus baseline increases. So we see this big number and lots of big numbers, but if we know which are using one-time and we know which ones are going to be continuing on in the future, that helps us understand how things fit together. The other data I was looking for on the added FTEs, how many current open positions do we have? Has there been any activity in redistribution of FTEs in order to fill more important roles? And I'm noticing that the proposal has an increase of a fair amount, like 1,300 one year and 1,400 another year of FTEs, and being able to understand some of the dynamics happening there, because when you're talking several thousand FTEs, that's a substantial part of the budget. So that if, and I understand that there's many open positions, so are those funds being carried over, being returned to the general fund since they're not being paid for employees? Basically, some of those details help us understand the whole picture. And I know they aren't huge, but they are substantial amounts.
Okay, so Representative Quam, let's put a pause right now. And what I'm going to do is ask Mr. Harney to maybe address the first part of your question about one-time versus ongoing money, and I don't know if he heard the whole question. Mr. Harney, do you want to?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, the answer will be more exact once I back out the financing from the Healthcare Access Fund to MA. But if you look at the first page of the spreadsheet on line 45, the total new general fund spending shows a savings of $495 million in the upcoming biennium, and a savings of $109 million in the tails. That difference gets to you to some estimate of what's one time and what's not, but I can give you a better exact answer once I back out the savings so you see the actual cost.
Thank you. And I,
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And part of that's for, you know, we have some newer members, and it's a complex system, but thank you for that.
Yeah, no kidding, Representative Quam. I mean, just so everybody understands, no matter how long you've been here, this is really complicated stuff. So no shame in asking any question, because believe me, I'm asking plenty of them. So, and the other part of your question, so I think Ms. Bailey was going to come up, and if you want to address anything about the funding piece, that would be great too, but also the question about the FTEs.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Quam. So we can get you data on the open positions right now. I would say for this package, more than half of those FTEs are actually maintained FTEs, so they're not new people that we're hiring. It's related to funding that we really need in our operating adjustment and a few other proposals that we're actually maintaining current staff.
Representative Quam?
Thank you. And if you can get a clarification on the portion that's remote and what you're using as a calculator for the deficiency, so that it oftentimes you need X number in office or you need X number they're working remote. So that way we can look at the total package and understand how you're doing your allocations. Thank you.
Ms. Bailey?
Chair, Mr. Senator, Representative Quam, I would say that, you know, the state has to have a remote workforce in order to compete in this market. And in a lot of cases, we're working much more efficiently than we have in the past. We can get you information about how many staff are remote, but I would note that it's at this point in the economy, it would almost be impossible to get folks to apply for our jobs if 100% of our workforce were in person.
Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair, I think we realize the realities, but understanding the makeup and the calculations helps us understand the justification for, you know, the FTEs that are listed in the budgeting. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Plum. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we parse out the human services and the health bills, I'm just wondering if somebody can let me know, where are the ORAC changes going to be housed? Are those going to be in human services, or are they going to be in this bill?
Mr. Harney.
Madam Chair, Representative Brindley, that will be in the human services finance bill.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to just echo your words about DHS, and, you know, it's just an amazing amount of work and programs that they're supplying and taking care of Minnesotans, and I just wanted to say thank you for all that work. In this moment, I just wanted to ask a few questions about the opioid prescribing and didn't know who might be able to assist in that questioning.
Ms. Bobston, maybe you need to phone a friend on that one, too, whoever needs to come down.
I have a friend coming down as well.
Great. Okay. Well, go ahead.
So maybe I'll just go with the first question, which is, as I read through the section around 126, 127, there's a lot of things said about community standards of prescribing, opioid prescribing community standards, community standard thresholds and community standard prescribing thresholds. So I did pull up the standards, which I found from the Department of Health, but I didn't find anything specifically relating to thresholds or prescribing thresholds, and I just wondered if that is somewhere in the bill that I missed.
And welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Sarah Orange. I work at the Department of Human Services.
And could you pull the mic just a bit closer? Thank you.
Hopefully this helps. You are correct. There are not mentions of the thresholds in this bill. That's because they were already established by the opioid prescribing work group several years ago. And so those exist in the program and have not been codified, however, so you do not see them in statute.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one follow-up on that then. So there were standards established in the opioid working group, and those are still being used today?
Ms. Orange?
Madam Chair, members, correct. Those are still used today. Particularly, those thresholds are used in our quality improvement work with prescribers.
And if I could, are those in rule somewhere, or they've got to be written somewhere?
Madam Chair, I believe they are available on our website, yes.
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, if we could just let the committee know what they are today. Is it 90, 50?
Ms. Orange.
Madam Chair, members, we can certainly provide that information. I will note something important to remember about the opioid prescribing improvement program and the QI efforts that go along with that is when we're looking at the prescribing activities of individuals, we really look at variation across across prescribers. So we're not trying to determine exactly, you know, this doctor should prescribe this much for this particular patient. We're really trying to encourage that doctors treat their patients in a patient-centered manner. And in fact, some of the language that you do see in this bill is seeking to specifically codify that value so that we aren't saying, you know, you should only prescribe up to 90 MME or, a unit, but rather that it should be a patient-centered choice based on the particular circumstances of that patient in front of the prescriber.
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, thank you, Ms. Orange, for that answer. And I did see that in the bill. That was the moment that my heart was a little warmed. So I will tell you that. That is the language of my bill from last year, and I appreciate you including that statement. But I will tell you that there's still a lot of, you know, frustration in the treatment of pain physicians at this time. There are people, you know, I'll get into it in a second, but I do want to just acknowledge that I did see that. But I think that in a, you know, we had the bill last year, we put a lot of work into it, and I don't see the results of that yet. In a state of Minnesota where Minnesota is one of the lower states in the union in prescribing opioids, you know, the opioid epidemic, which we are all hearing about, and I think a lot of people conflate these two issues, pain treatment with opioids, using it as it should be used, versus an epidemic, which is worse than it's ever been, despite the best efforts from, you know, what's happened in Minnesota, and very valuable efforts, I will add. You know, the work we've done in Minnesota from 2016 and even before to reduce opioid prescribing for hospital visits, et cetera, has been wonderful and has been effective. And now we're at a point now where we need to allow pain patients to receive the medications they need. And as you said, Ms. Orange, the pain physicians being allowed to practice in a patient-centered approach is what we need to see. But we're still seeing highly trained specialists who, over and over again, what we're hearing is that they should have their leeway, but they're not really getting it yet, and they're being sanctioned with letters, and that work continues. I will at this moment pause and just say thank you for doing the work you're doing in this area presently and having allowed me to sit in on some of those meetings to listen. That's very valuable so I can understand, and I appreciate that. I'm just raising this issue up because, you know, we hear and see in print what that desire is, but elsewhere in the bill, I'm not sure it exists. And so I'll just go with one final question, which is there any other area of medicine that DHS regulates prescribing?
Ms. Orange.
Madam Chair and members, I'm afraid I'm not equipped to answer that. My area particularly oversees the Opioid Prescribing Improvement Program, and I can't say definitively for that matter. With that said, I would say we certainly appreciate your participation in our conversations recently with pain providers. We are planning to address some of the concerns they have, as you know. But with that said, we have very purposefully limited the work that pain specialists have had to do under our QI requirements. In fact, in 2022, we knew, based on the conversations from last session, that there were concerns and thereby waived all of the pain specialists from their requirements. So I would really just challenge that, you know, they have been overburdened at this point, because we are actively trying to work with them, and we have waived their requirements for the last year.
Madam Chair, just a final comment, and I appreciate that response, and I appreciate the work you're doing in that area, and I think it is very challenging. This issue is extremely challenging for all, but I would say no more challenging than for the doctors who have left the practice. Pain physicians are harder to find, as we know, for patients who are in need, and essentially pain patients have been cut adrift in many cases, in which case some of them go to the street for medication because there are no other solutions for them, which has, you know, increased some of the deaths. But, you know, it is a complicated issue, opioids, and I appreciate the work of DHS, and I do look forward to continuing to work with you on it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Orange. Are there other member questions or comments? All right. I am not seeing any. And, of course, we will have further discussion on any of these issues as they show up or don't in the DE. And, Commissioner, did you want to say any final words before we recess, because we're not going to adjourn today. We're going to recess. And, okay, so no final words. So, members, thank you very much. And, you know, as always, I appreciate everybody's eyes on everything, because there is a lot here and it is very complicated. So all questions are you know, no dumb questions in this space, as far as I'm concerned anyway. And so we're going to go into recess, and we're going to come back at 6 o'clock in this room to take up some other bills. So with that, we are in recess.